Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven. Political agitator, taking part in labor demonstrations and strikes.
He adopted the name Koba after a fictional Georgian outlaw hero and joined the more militant wing of the Marxist Social Democratic Movement, the Bolsheviks led by Vladimir Lenin. Now, during this time, Stalin also became involved in various criminal activities, including bank heists, the proceeds from which were used to help fund the Bolshevik Party. He was arrested multiple times between the years 1902 and 1913 and subjected to imprisonment and eventually even exile in Siberia. In 1906, Stalin married Ekaterina Kato-Svidnadze, who lived from 1885 to 1907, a seamstress. The couple had one son, Yakov, who would only live from 1907 to 1943, who died as a prisoner in Germany during World War II. So this is why he didn't live past 1943. Now, Ekaterina would perish from typhus when her son was an infant. In 1918, although some sources cite 1919, Stalin would marry his second wife, Nadia Aleuvia, who was around from 1901 to 1932, the daughter of a Russian revolutionary. So it was sort of a match made in heaven for the two of them. They had two children, a boy and a girl, but eventually Nadezhda would commit suicide in her early 30s. Apparently there's something a little bit wrong with Stalin. Now, Stalin also fathered several children out of wedlock. He was by no means the perfect gentleman when it came to marriage. And as you will soon see, he was by no means a perfect gentleman in any facet of life. Now, in 1912, Lenin was exiled in Switzerland and appointed Joseph Stalin to serve on the first Central Committee of the Bolshevik Party. 3 years later, in November of 1917, the Bolsheviks seized power in Russia. Now, this is significant because during this glorious revolution, where the Bolsheviks would seize power, Russia was currently engaged in the First World War, along with Germany, France, and the United States. Now, Russia had entered, and as well as Britain. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention them, and a few others, Italy and Spain, briefly. But, interestingly enough, the Russians had entered on the side of France, and then the Bolsheviks overthrew the Tsar, and this completely pulled Russia out of the war, basically for the duration of the First World War, and almost becomes a turning point. Now, the Soviet Union is founded 5 years later in 1922 with Lenin as its first leader. Now, during these years, Stalin continued to move up the party ladder. And in 1922, he becomes the Secretary General of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, a role that enabled him to appoint his to government jobs and grow a base of political support for himself. After Lenin died 2 years later in 1924, Stalin eventually would outmaneuver all of his rivals and win the power struggle for control of the Communist Party. By the late 1920s, he had become the complete, total dictator of the Soviet Union. Now, it's important to note that during this time, when I say political maneuvering, let me just explain to you exactly what I mean. Do I mean by political maneuvering? Well, important to note that the first thing that Stalin did when he became appointed to the Central Committee was befriend two high-ranking military officials, Clement Voroshilov and Semyon Boryany, who would end up forming the nucleus of his military and political support base. Now, this was the first thing that he did to sort of cement himself. This is during the Russian Civil War. This is during the period of time in which he is aiding the party in taking over. Now, following Lenin's death in 1924, Stalin himself saw only one threat, really, to his power, and that was Trotsky. And Trotsky, for those of you unfamiliar with him, was another very influential member of the party, the Communist Party at the time, Leon Trotsky, had garnered quite a bit in the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, and was one of the leading members of the Bolshevik Party, one of the faces of their revolution, so to speak. So it's pretty clear to Stalin at this point that this is his real obstacle for taking over. So while he noticed that before Lenin's death, Stalin saw the writing on the wall. He knew that Lenin was not in the best health, and he entered into a anti-Trotsky alliance with Kamenev and Grigory Zinoviev. Now, Zinoviev had expressed concern about Stalin's growing authority and rallied behind, but despite this, he rallied behind him at the 13th Congress as a counterweight to Trotsky, who led a party faction known as the Left Opposition. The Left Opposition believed too many concessions to capitalism had been made, and Stalin had been deemed too rightist in the party for his support of the policy. Now, Stalin had built up a retinue of supporters in the Central Committee, while the Left Opposition were gradually removed from their positions of influence. He was supported in this by a few individuals, Bukharin and a number of others, but eventually, Stalin began to undermine individuals by removing people that supported them from key positions. So in 1924, Stalin removed Kamenev and Zinoviev's supporters from key positions, and in 1925, they attempted to undercut him again. So in response to this, Stalin would figure out all the members of what he was calling the Trotskyites, and not only get them removed from the Central Committee through removing their key supporters from key positions, but then he would exile a number of them. So in October of 1927, Zinoviev and Trotsky ended up losing their positions in the Central Committee because they lost their supporters, mainly because Stalin got rid of them. Now, after they were gone, they are later exiled to Kazakhstan and then deported from the country in 1929. Now, some of those members of the United Opposition were repentant and were later rehabilitated and allowed to return. But Stalin at this point was able to, after taking away the key supporters in these smaller positions within the government, was able to become the supreme leader of the party. Another important aspect of how Stalin managed to further consolidate his power was by ensuring that only the people that he felt he could trust the most ran state institutions and ran any key aspects of the party. So once he had managed to lock that up, starting in the late 1920s, Stalin launched a series of five-year plans that were intended to transform the Soviet Union from a peasant society into an industrial superpower. His development plan was centered on government control of the economy and included the forced collectivization of Soviet agriculture, in which the government took control of farms, and millions of farmers find out that by not cooperating with Stalin, there were only two other options for you. Stalin made it abundantly clear that by not cooperating, you were not working towards this greater good that he had in mind for the nation, and so you would be promptly either exiled or shot, and millions of people found this out the hard way. The forced collectivization led to widespread famine across the Soviet Union that also killed millions of people. Stalin himself ruled through terror and with a total totalitarian grip in order to eliminate anyone who might oppose him. He expanded the powers of his secret police, encouraged citizens to spy on one another, and had millions of people killed or sent to the Gulag system of forced labor camps. During the second half of the 1930s, Stalin instituted another policy known as the Great Purge, which was a series of campaigns designed specifically to rid the Communist Party and the military, as well as other parts of Soviet society, from those who considered a threat. And this harkens back to what he had done to Trotsky and his supporters to take control of the party to begin with. In addition to that, Stalin gradually began to build a cult of personality around himself in the Soviet Union. Cities were renamed in his honor, Soviet history books were rewritten to give him a more prominent role in the revolution, and mythologized other aspects of his life came the subject of flattering artwork, literature, and music, and his name became part of the Soviet national anthem. His government also controlled the Soviet media, making it virtually impossible for every citizen in his country not to be exposed to his propaganda around the clock. Now, before we continue on talking about Stalin, We've gotten to the point where we've talked about the consolidation of his power and some of the underhanded tactics he used to get to a point where he could have full control, but we've only scratched the surface. Before we continue on, though, we have a proud new sponsor of Totally Driven Entertainment. He's wacky, he's funny, he's crazy, and he's totally driven. Guys, we're going to take a commercial break. Check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com, and when we get back, we're going to get deeper into Joseph Stalin's legacy. We're going to talk about his role during the Second World War, and then we are going to get into one of history's greatest crimes and one of the largest cover-ups in human history, and that is the Holodomor. So we'll be back after the commercial break. Enjoy.
I'm black man, baby man dies, one stereotype at a time.
To the black mother. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is a perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes' native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today. at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your cool friend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back to the Bareback Facts. As always, I'm your host, Big D, and we were talking about Joseph Stalin and how he managed to consolidate his power after his coup and how he managed to keep hold of it. Now, before the break, I mentioned that Joseph Stalin reigned through terror. He integrated and ingratiated himself with every aspect of Soviet society. He manipulated history so that he could be the hero of all the old stories. He implanted himself and embedded himself firmly in the minds of his citizens as not only their supreme leader, but also within the Soviet Union and as basically their deity. Now, in 1939, Joseph Stalin had a pretty good thing going for himself. He was in pretty much complete control at this point of the Soviet Union. On the eve of the Second World War, Stalin and Adolf Hitler signed a non-aggression pact. Stalin then proceeded to annex parts of Poland and Romania, as well as the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. He would also launch an invasion of Finland. And in June of 1941, things would go sour in a hurry. Like many of Joseph Stalin's political machinations, this too would end in bloodshed. Only this time, his political machinations would cost the lives of more people than simply his political opponents. It would cost the Russian people their very lifeblood. Now, in 1941, Germany would break the Nazi-Soviet pact, and they would invade the USSR, making significant early inroads. Now, Stalin, at this time, had ignored warnings from the Americans and the British, as well as his own intelligence agents' potential invasion, and the Soviets, as a consequence of this, were not prepared for war with Germany. As German troops approached the Soviet capital of Moscow, Stalin remained there and directed a scorched-earth defensive policy, destroying any supplies or infrastructure that might benefit the enemy. But by doing so, he crippled his own people because he took away their resources. For those of you unfamiliar with how a scorched earth policy is conducted, the premise of scorched earth policy is you leave nothing behind that your enemy can use against you. You destroy all resources. That includes farmland, that includes building materials, that includes food, resources of any kind, water sources. The Soviets under Stalin became so desperate to defeat the Nazis at any cost that they were willing to destroy themselves and their own future to get the job done. At least that was the mentality that Stalin had in dealing with the Third Reich and their soldiers. Now, Stalin, fortunately for him and the Soviets, paid off. The tide turned for the Soviets at the Battle of Stalingrad conducted from August 1942 to February of 1943, during which the Red Army defeated the Germans and eventually drove them from Russia. And the crowd goes wild, right? Everything's great. Wrong. As the war had progressed, Stalin participated in major conferences, including the Tehran Conference in 1943 and the Yalta Conference in 1945, and his iron will and deft political skills enabled him to play the loyal ally while never abandoning his vision of an expanded post-war Soviet empire. So even despite all of this, the Soviets are still suffering a great deal during the Second World War. Now, Stalin didn't mellow out following the Second World War and didn't just get caught, you know, didn't just chill out in his old age. He prosecuted a reign of terror, purges, executions, exiles to labor camps, and a persecution into the post-war USSR that was designed to suppress all dissent and anything that smacked of foreign, especially Western, influence. He established communist governments throughout Eastern Europe, and in 1949, he led the Soviets into the nuclear age by exploding an atomic bomb. In 1950, he gave North Korea's communist leader Kim Il-sung permission to invade United States-supported South Korea, and an event triggering an event we now know to be the Korean War. Stalin grew increasingly paranoid in his later years and would eventually die on March 5th of 1953 at the age of 74 after suffering a stroke. Time to dig a little bit deeper. Some historians estimate that Stalin is responsible for the deaths of at least 20 million people during his rule. But one key aspect of Stalin's rule we kind of glossed over is the Holodomor. If you don't know what the Holodomor is, there's a good reason for that. Because during the period in which the Soviet Union was still around, it was one of the closely guarded secrets. Now, the Holodomor takes place from 1932 to 1931, and it refers specifically to a brutal artificial famine imposed by Stalin's regime on Soviet Ukraine and primarily ethnically Ukrainian areas in the Northern Caucasus. Now, in its broadest sense, it is used to describe the Ukrainian genocide that technically began in 1929 with massive waves of deadly deportations of Ukraine's most successful farmers, the Kerkels or Kulaks in Russian, as well as the deportations and executions of Ukraine's religious, intellectual, and cultural leaders. In the devastating forced famine that followed, the genocide, in fact, actually continued for several more years with the further destruction of Ukraine's political leadership, the resettlement of Ukraine's depopulated areas with other ethnic groups, and the prosecution of those who dared to speak of the famine publicly, as well as the consistent blatant denial of the famine by the Soviet regime. Now, many Ukrainian farmers in 1929 who were known for their independence still refused to join the new process that had come about when Stalin had taken power. As I mentioned earlier, one of the key policies within Stalin's plans for a bright and brave new future for the Soviet Union was collectivization of all farmland. This meant that all farmland was going to be redistributed through the communist system and was going to be regulated and controlled by the Soviet government. Now, many Ukrainian farmers refused to join the collective farms. And this could not be allowed under Stalin, not only because he couldn't bear to have anybody, shirk or spit in the face of his power, but also because the Ukraine actually possessed some of the more fertile farmland in the Soviet Union, something that Joseph Stalin needed in order to feed his massive population. Now, many Ukrainian farmers saw the collectivization of farmland as being similar to a return to serfdom of the earlier centuries that they had endured. And Stalin himself had introduced a policy of class warfare in the countryside in order to break down resistance to collectivization, citing that many farmers were kind of like the old landlords of the Middle Ages, and that, you know, they're the only reason anybody would ever be against this is because they don't want to be part of the collective. They don't want to be part of this glorious, you know, Soviet Union. They don't want to be part of our new system. They're too good for us. The successful farmers, or kerkels, kulaks in the Russian, are branded as the class enemy. And brutal enforcement by regular troops and secret police is used to liquidate them as a class. Eventually, anyone who resists collectivization or anyone who resists policies that Stalin had put forth as far as the new economic policies went was now labeled a kerkel or kulak. Now, and by 1930, approximately 1.5 million Ukrainians fall victim to Stalin's de-kukalization policies, and over the extended period of collectivization and armed de-kukalization brigades begin to be formed, and they forcibly confiscate land, livestock, and other properties, and evict entire families from their homes. A million individuals in the Ukraine are dragged from their homes, packed into freight trains, and shipped to remote, uninhabited areas like Siberia, where they and their children are often left without food or shelter and die. Many people, especially children, would die in transit or soon thereafter. Now, during the 30s, as you know, Russia was in the midst of its war efforts. They were annexing other parts of Eastern Europe and expanding. And because they were expanding, they needed more food. So from 1932 to 1933, the Soviet government sharply increased the Ukraine's production quotas, ensuring that these quotas could not be met. Starvation becomes widespread. And in the summer of 1932, a decree is implemented that calls for the arrest or execution of any person, even a child, found taking as little as a few stalks of wheat or any possible food item from the fields where he worked. By decree, discriminatory voucher systems are implemented and the military blockades are erected around many Ukrainian villages, preventing the transport of food into these villages and the hungry from leaving in search of food. Brigades of young activists from other Soviet regions are brought in to sweep through villages and confiscate any hidden grain and eventually any and all food from the farmers' homes. Stalin states of Ukraine that the national question isn't a rural question, and he and his commanders determined to teach a lesson through famine, and ultimately to deal a crushing blow to the backbone of Ukraine, its rural population. Now, by June, at the height of the famine, people in the Ukraine are dying at the rate of 30,000 people a day. 30,000 people a day. Now, nearly a third of them are children and under the age of 10. Between 1932 and 1934, approximately 4 million deaths are attributed to starvation within the borders of Soviet Ukraine. And this does not include the deaths that occur as a consequence of deportations, executions, and deaths from ordinary causes. Now, Stalin denies to the world that there is any famine in Ukraine in 1933 and continues to export millions of tons of grain, more than enough to have saved every starving man, woman, and child, and funnel them throughout the Soviet Union. Now, any report of famine in Russia today is an exaggeration of malignant propaganda. There's no actual starvation or deaths from starvation, but there is widespread mortality from diseases due to malnutrition, as reported by the New York Times correspondent and Pulitzer Prize winner Walter Duranty during this time. This is during 1933. These are the things people are saying. Denial of the famine by Soviet authorities was echoed at the time of the famine by prominent Western journalists like Walter Duranty. The Soviet Union adamantly refused any outside assistance because the regime officially denied that there was any need for assistance because there was no famine taking place. People were just sick. They were just dying as a consequence of malnutrition. And there's no famine going on. No. There's just disease, and people just get sick. They die, you know. Anyone claiming the contrary was accused of spreading anti-Soviet propaganda. Outside the Soviet Union, Western governments adopted a passive attitude toward the famine, although most of them had become aware of the true suffering in Ukraine through confidential diplomatic channels. In fact, in November of 1933, the United States, under newly elected President Franklin D. Roosevelt, chose to formally recognize Stalin's communist government and also negotiated a sweeping new trade agreement with them. The following year, the pattern of denial in the West culminated with the admission of the Soviet Union into the League of Nations. Now, Stalin's five-year plans for the modernization of Soviet Union depended largely on the purchase of massive amounts of manufactured goods and technology from Western nations. And those nations were unwilling to disrupt lucrative trade agreements with the Soviet Union in order to pursue the matter of the famine. So in this moment, not only was Russia committing a genocide, but they're actively being ignored in their commitment to genocide, because it's more profitable to support them through trade. So important to note that evil was being done in 1933, and it was an evil that people knew about but chose to do nothing about. Now, in the ensuing decades, Ukrainian emigre groups sought acknowledgement of this tragic and massive genocide that took place, but with little success. And it's not until the 1980s, with the publication of eminent scholar Robert Conquest's Harvest of Sorrow, the report of the U.S. Commission on the Ukraine Famine, and the findings of the International Commission of Inquiry into the 1932-1933 famine in Ukraine, and the release of an eye-opening documentary called The Harvest of Despair, that greater world attention comes to bear on this event. In Soviet Ukraine, of course, the Holodomor was kept out of official discourse until the late and shortly before Ukraine won its independence in 1991. With the fall of the Soviet Union and the dissolution of its holds on various parts of Eastern Europe, previously inaccessible archives, as well as the long-suppressed oral testimony of Holodomor survivors living in Ukraine, have yielded massive evidence, offering incontrovertible evidence of Ukraine's tragic famine genocide of the 1930s. And on November 28th of 2006, the Verkhova Rada, the Parliament of Ukraine, passed a decree defining the Holodomor as a deliberate act of genocide, although the Russian government continues to this day to call Ukraine's depiction of the famine a one-sided falsification of history. It is recognized as a genocide by approximately 24 countries and is now the focus of considerable international research and documentation. For those of you who have never heard of this, there's a reason you've never heard of it, because in many cases, it's not very well talked about. In fact, it's really not even all that much acknowledged, even in the scholarship that we have on it. There's really not calling for research until the late 80s, early 90s. So you don't really hear anything about this genocide until then. And by then, that's 50 years before anybody really starts looking at what actually happened to these people during this time. So let's just take a look at how many people are estimated to have died during this period of time. The estimated deaths involved with the or tied to the Holodomor, recent research has narrowed it down between approximately 2.5 to 7.5 million people. But the exact number of deaths is still to this day incredibly hard to determine due to a lack of records. The number increases significantly, though, when the deaths in heavily Ukrainian-populated Kuban are included. Older estimates are still often cited in political commentary. And according to the findings of the Court of Appeal in Kyiv in 2010, the demographic losses due to the famine amounted to 10 million, with 3.9 million people dying direct from the famine and another 6.1 million due to birth deficit. So this is an enormous, enormous loss of life. Not be limited in ourselves just to the Holodomor. Because the Holodomor is not the only way in which Stalin not only solidified his power, but also got rid of his political opponents. We're going to take one more commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Joseph Stalin's other brainchild, the Gulag system. Because much like Hitler, with a way to use his undesirables to benefit his own ends. And the Gulag system is that way. So when we come back, we will talk about the Gulag system and Stalin's brutal campaign of forced labor. But before we go to commercial break, it's important that I remind you guys, of course, that we have a proud new sponsor, Totally Driven Entertainment. He's funny, he's wacky, and he's crazy. Check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
I'm black man. Baby man dies. One stereotype at a time.
To the black mother. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, restaurant owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Bareback Facts, History, and Blood. And before we went to the break, we talked about the Hall of the Moor and the massive death toll that accumulated following a man-made government-imposed famine in the Ukraine under the direct orders of Joseph Stalin. Now, we also talked briefly about the gulags. People talk about gulags, and sometimes even in a joking manner, but I can assure you that the gulag is nothing to joke about, not by any stretch of the imagination. It certainly wasn't for those people in Russia. So what is the gulag? What is that? Well, it is an acronym in Russian, but it essentially translates to the main camps administration or chief administration of corrective labor camps. It's a government agency created under Lenin and reinstituted and used by Stalin as a way to get rid of his political opponents. So what was it like? What were these? Essentially, the gulags, the gulag program was a program involving work camps. These work camps became part of the Russian penal system, and they were originally an effort to reduce the prison system's population. But eventually, under Stalin, they become the perfect way to get rid of all of your political opponents. Now, this system is instituted from about 1919 to 1934, and then it continues from 1934 to about 1956, roughly 1954 to 1956. So this is quite a period. So roughly from 1919 to 1956, in some way, shape, or form, the Russians were implementing the gulag system. Now, what were the conditions? Living and working conditions in the camps varied significantly across time and place and depended, among other things, on the impact of broader events such as the Second World War, countrywide famines, shortages, waves of terror, sudden influxes or releases of large numbers of prisoners. However, to one degree to another, the large majority of prisoners at most times faced meager food rations, inadequate clothing, overcrowding, poorly insulated housing, poor hygiene, and inadequate health care. Most prisoners were compelled to perform harsh physical labor, and by compelled we mean they were beaten quite savagely if they didn't do it. In most periods in economic branches, the degree of mechanization of work processes was significantly lower than in the civilian industry. Tools were often primitive, and machinery, if existent, was in short supply. Officially established work hours were in most periods longer, and days off were fewer than for civilian workers. Often official work time regulations were extended by local camp administrators. One procurator of the Soviet Union, Andrei Vyshinsky, wrote a memorandum to the chief, Nikolai Yekshov, in 1938, which stated, "Among the prisoners, there are some so ragged and lice ridden, they pose a sanitary danger to the rest. These prisoners have deteriorated to the point of losing any resemblance to human beings. Lacking food, they collect quartz, refuse, and according to some prisoners, eat rats and dogs. Now, in general, the central administrative bodies showed a discernible interest in maintaining the labor force of prisoners in a condition allowing the fulfillment of construction and production plans handed down from above. But besides a wide array of punishments for prisoners refusing to work, which infractors were sometimes applied to prisoners too enfeebled to meet their production quotas to begin with, they instituted a number of positive incentives intended to boost productivity, including monetary bonuses, 30s, and wage payments from the 50s onwards, cuts of individual sentences, general early release schemes for norm and fulfillment and overfulfillment, and until 1939, again, in selected camps from 1946 onwards. Keep in mind, this is not all camps. This is only some of them. Preferential treatment and privileges for the most productive workers was also offered to people. And it's a distinctive incentive scheme that included both coercive and motivational elements and was applied universally in all camps consisted in standardized nourishment scales. The size of the inmate's ration depended on the percentage of the work quota delivered. Nathalie Frankel is credited for the introduction of this policy, and while it was effective in compelling many prisoners to work harder, for many a prisoner it had the adverse effect, accelerating the exhaustion and sometimes causing the death of persons unable to fulfill high production quotas. Immediately after the German attack on the Soviet Union in 1941, the conditions in camps worsened drastically. Quotas were increased, rations are cut, and medical supplies come to close to none at all, all of which lead to a sharp increase in mortality. The situation slowly improved in the final period and after the end of the war. Considering the overall conditions and their influence on inmates, it's important to distinguish the three major strata of Gulag inmates. Important that we take a look at the different groups. So we have the Kulaks, Osiniks, and Utsiniks, people sentenced for violations of various laws, such as the law of Spirkalets, decree about work discipline, occasional violators of criminal law, and of course political opponents. Then we have dedicated criminals, and then we have people sentenced for various religious or political reasons. The mortality in Gulag camps from 1934 to 1940 was 4 to 6 times higher than the average in the Soviet Union. The estimated total number of those who died in imprisonment from 1930 to 1953 is at least 1.76 million, about half of which occur between 1941 and 1943 following the German invasion. If prisoner deaths from labor colonies and special settlements are included, the death toll rises to about 2.7 million. Although it's important to note that the historian J. Otto Pohl, who compiled this estimate, stresses that it's incomplete and doesn't cover all prisoner categories for every year. Remember the severe famine that swept across many different regions in the Soviet Union from the period of 1931 to 1932. During this time, it's estimated that around 6 to 7 million people starved to death. And on August 7th of 1932, a new edict is drafted by Stalin, which specified a minimum of 10 years or execution for theft from collective farms or of cooperative property. And over the next few months, prosecutions rose fourfold. A large share of cases prosecuted under the law were for the theft of small quantities of grain worth less than 50 rubles. The law was then relaxed later on May 8th of 1933. But overall, the first half of the 1933 prison saw more new incoming inmates than the previous 3 years combined. Prisoners in the camps would face harsh working conditions. One Soviet report stated in early 1933, up to 15% the prison population in Uzbekistan would die monthly. During this time, prisoners were getting around 300 calories of food a day. Many inmates attempted to flee, causing an upsurge in coercive and violent measures. camps were directed not to spare bullets. If anybody caused any problem at all, they were shot promptly and just kind of they just dropped where they were, wherever they dropped. They just kind of left them there. The bodies of inmates who tried to escape were commonly displayed in the courtyards of camps when they didn't just leave them there. And the administrators would forcibly escort the inmates around the dead bodies as a message to them that should they choose not to work hard, they could choose to be a corpse. Until 1934, lack of food and the outbreak of diseases started to destabilize the gulag system, and it wasn't until the famine ended that the system started to stabilize again. Now, the gulag itself, the overall death toll, it's difficult still to this day to determine how many people died. During the decades before the dissolution of the USSR, the debates about the population size of gulag failed to arrive at a generally accepted figure. Wide-ranging estimates have been offered, and the bias toward higher or lower side was sometimes ascribed to the political views of the particular author. Some of those earlier estimates, both high and lower, show have been still debated, as I said, and the final estimates of the gulag population will only be available when all Soviet archives will be open, as some of them are not still open, and there is data missing. But if you look at the writings of a number of historians, it's estimated that the population of the gulag, at least according to Mora and Zwiernig, from 1940 to 1942, is upwards of 15 million people. Then we have a collective work done by Zoltzhensinin, and it's in a book, The Gulag Archipelago 2, published with Harper and Row. The estimate is from, I believe, the year 1940 to 1953, and it's estimated that approximately 50 million people during that time possibly passed through the gulag system. Nonetheless, it's still very difficult, as I said, for people to determine how many people went through this, but one scholar, Robert, and one of the more foremost groups of scholars are convinced, this includes Robert Conquest or Stephen Wheatcroft, to reconsider the earlier estimates of the size of the gulag population. There are high numbers of arrested and deaths are not radically different. Scholars such as Rosenfield and Vishnevsky at certain points point to several inconsistencies in archival data, pointing out the archival figure of 1.1 million for the population of the gulag and labor colonies combined on December 31st of 1936 is less than half of the 2.75 million labor camp population given to the Census Board for the 1937 census. It's generally believed that these data provide more reliable and detailed information that the indirect data and literary sources available for scholars during the Cold War did. Now, what can we glean? Well, the data that we have allowed scholars to conclude that during the period from between 1928 to 1953, at least 15 million prisoners passed through the system of the gulag. These figures, though, reflect the number of convicted persons and do not take into account the fact that a significant part of gulag inmates had been convicted more than one time, so the actual number of convicted is somewhat overstated. Still, the gulag itself spanned nearly 40 years of Soviet and Eastern European history, and it has affected millions of individuals. There's quite a bit of actually quite a bit more written on this than there was of the Holodomor. But when we look at the death toll, this is where it becomes difficult for people to determine just how many people died during the gulags. Now, the death toll, according to a 1993 study of archival Soviet data, A total of 1,053,829 people died in the Gulag just from 1934 to 1953. But there is no real archival data that we've gotten our hands on as of yet for the period of 1919 or 1934. But taking into account the likelihood of unreliable record keeping and the fact that it was common practice to release prisoners who suffered from incurable diseases or near death, non-state estimates of the actual Gulag death toll are actually higher. According to estimates based on the Soviet, based on data from Soviet archives, there were around at least 1.6 million deaths during the whole period from 1929 to 1953. Although other estimates from scholars such as Robert Conquest go beyond 10 million, the Russian historian Golfo Alexopoulos said most recently, as this year, that at least 6 million people died in the Gulag. So, and this is in his work, which he published with the Yale University Press, Illness and Humanity in Stalin's Gulag, for those of you interested in taking a look at it. It's one of the more recent books done on the Gulag, so worth a look. But nonetheless, it's clear, Stalin himself was responsible for numerous deaths, and at the very least is responsible for several million people meeting their end prematurely. And whether that's through whether that's through government-imposed famines, labor camps, executions, and government purges, Stalin has left a bloody mark on history that will never wash away. And it's always going to be in the minds of not only people within Russia, but it's also going to always be in the minds of those people affected most. And those are the people of the Ukraine and parts of Eastern Europe that fell under Soviet rule and dominion both during the Second World War and in the aftermath of the Second World War during what we call the Cold War. So that's all I've got for you guys today on this. If you're interested in looking at some more about Joseph Stalin, there is quite a bit of literature written on him. I did mention the book by Golfo Alexopoulos. You should definitely take a look at that if you're interested in the Gulags, Illness and Humanity in Stalin's Gulag. But I also want to recommend for all of you that you take a look at Holodomor CT.org history. This is a look at this is a compiled look at the Holodomor, and it's been done by the Connecticut Holodomor Committee. This is a site dedicated to educating people on the Holodomor. It has eyewitness accounts, survivor accounts, and they continue to not only support survivors, but also to keep their story alive, to make sure that their story doesn't disappear. So definitely take a look at that. You'll also want to take a look at gulaghistory.org for those of you interested in learning a little bit more about the Gulag system and how the Soviet Union dealt with its prisoners, how Joseph Stalin and, of course, Lenin before him managed to deal with all their prisoners and how they forced people to labor until basically death. But for more specifically on Stalin, there is a good deal of literature written on him. It's kind of hit or miss. I mean, you can do wrong, but really is an abundance of literature written on him. I would say probably the best place to start. Some of the best places to start, you can look at Stalin's Last Crime, The Plot Against the Jewish Doctors by Vladimir Nemov and Jonathan Brent. Robert Conquest, Stalin, The Breaker of Nations. You can look at Norman Davies, White Eagle, Red Star, The Polish-Soviet War in 1919 to 1920. You can take a look at The Soviet Decision for a Pact with Nazi Germany by Jeffrey Roberts. You can look at Jeffrey Roberts' Stalin's Wars from World War to Cold War, 1939 to 1953. And a great source as well as Mark Sandel's A Short History of Soviet Socialism. Definitely something to read if you're interested in gaining a better understanding of the way that Soviet government sort of operated and how they administrated and how they did, how they instituted programs. I would also recommend taking a look at Dmitry Volkogonov's Stalin, Triumph and Tragedy. And finally, there is another book that I think is a good read as well. It's translated by Nora Seligman, and that's Stalin, A New Biography of a Dictator, originally written by Oleg Van Klevenuk. So I hope you guys have enjoyed today's show. Hope you learned a lot. I do have a special announcement to make. I do have a guest coming in on the 22nd of December. Very excited about it. You may know him as the Cali Effect, King of Games, famous YugiTuber. Very excited to have him on. Hope all of his fans will come in and listen. Hopefully you guys will be able to call in and talk to him directly. I'm very excited to have him on and talk about his various projects and all the work that he's doing. And that's what we've got on the docket. Thanks for tuning in today. Of course, you guys can catch me Sunday with Straight Football Talk at 9 in the morning. And don't forget to catch me next Wednesday. This has been another edition of the Bareback Facts, History and Blood, and I will see you all very soon.